So, last but not least was Franz Nicolaas Meyer. He was born in 1875 in the Netherlands. Already by the sixth grade, he knew what he wanted to do with his life. He wanted to go around the world collecting and studying plants. Unfortunately, by the age of 14, his parents could no longer afford to send him to school, so he went to work as a gardener's assistant with Hugo de Vries at the Amsterdam Botanical Garden. But during his time there, he spent his free time walking across Europe, collecting plants, making herbarium species, specimens, and also learning foreign languages. Well, he had to spend a year in the military service, but after that, he decided he wanted to emigrate to America. So off he went in 1900 to England, worked long enough there to secure passage to the U.S. Once he arrived, he immediately changed his name to Frank Meyer and arrived in Washington, D.C., where he did secure a job working in the USDA greenhouses, and he only got paid $600. These other guys got paid a lot better. I'm just finding that out now. But again, he was not your model employee. I mean, this is like your worst nightmare, hiring this guy. So he has this terrible case of wanderlust, so he decides he wants to go out to California, and he only stayed at that job for 18 months. And off he goes to Mexico. He collects there for 3 months. And this guy walks. I mean, this guy is a hiker. And he sends stone fruit back, also cactus, back to the newly formed Chico Plant Introduction Garden. Well, yellow fever hits there. So off he goes to Cuba. And he wanted to study pineapples and other tropicals there. And then that didn't last very long, and off he goes back to New Orleans, Birmingham, and by that time he's flat broke. So he has to go back to work again. And so fortunately they hired him at the Missouri Botanical Gardens as a propagator, and he also served as a judge, primarily for forestry crops, at the World's Fair there. So already he's planning his next expedition. He wanted, after that, to go to South America to go through the mountains and study plants there. He wrote, "Traveling and wandering are the only things that interest me. I get tired of regular surroundings." And so, again, he, thank goodness that USDA was hiring then. And so he gets a job to go collect in China. So he has this whirlwind training period, 10 whole days on-the-job training at New York Botanical Garden and also Arnold Arboretum. And this is really significant because there he meets Charles Sprague Sargent, who he has a love-hate relationship with the rest of his career. But fortunately today, Arnold Arboretum holds lots of his materials, photographs, a lot of his herbarium specimens. So his first mission then was to find economically important plants. So his first expedition, 1905 to 1908, he explores northern China, Korea, and Siberia. And these were perilous times. This was during the period of the post-Boxer Rebellion, great distress of Caucasians, foreigners, plant collectors, and oftentimes in these very remote areas, he was the first Caucasian ever seen. So normally he would get up at about 3:30 in the morning. You slaggards, most of you weren't here at 8 o'clock this morning. So he got up at 3:30 in the morning. Off he went and collected till dark. He criticized his colleagues because they rode in these donkey carts, but nope, he walked. He walked the first 3 months. He wore out several suits of clothes, and he also wore out 3 pairs of shoes. Now, this was not the time of universal currency, so he had these donkey carts loaded with currency. And of course, you know, this was all in coin, so he had to lug all this coinage with him, which set him up for a lot of robberies as well. So during all these expeditions, I mean, this guy survived typhoons, dust storms, ice storms. He got beat up several times. He also did stab a guy, and he did carry a pistol with him. But he was kind of a prickly fellow. But he also had to endure these, conditions where oftentimes he'd stay in these one-room inns where they had brick beds, and you shared a bed with 6 to 12 other people. And he wrote to Fairchild that one night he was bitten by no less than 6 kinds of vermin. And, some of these vermin carry diseases, too. So his first expedition, his first major discovery was Diospyros khaki, Chinese persimmon. And he was most impressed with this because they were so much bigger than Virginiana, the Native American species. He also saw Diospyros lotus, which was used as rootstock. And here you can see where he collected in this photograph. I would say that's probably drought resistant, pretty good drought resistance there. And he also collected a lot of things that he felt suitable for alkaline soils. He also collected things that would later become rootstocks. But another interesting thing is that he really perfected the method for shipping, as we talked about before. It took a long time to ship things back. And so on his way over, he stopped in Japan. He had to buy his peat moss there. And then he would make oiled paper, pack his material in that, and then he would hand sew his burlap bags and then store at, some of these offices, and then off they would go back to America. So from 1906 to 1907, again, as was mentioned before, people often collected hardy germplasm during this time. One of his significant finds then was zoysia grass, which if you're in the Midwest or Upper South, zoysia grass. Also, an ornamental cherry that was named for him. And again, a lot of ornamentals and agronomic species as well. And also during this time, in his spare time, he was trying to learn these Chinese languages and the 400 dialects. So in 1907, he had great disappointment. Fairchild struck this deal with Sargent at Arnold Arboretum that one of their collectors, W.H. Wilson, who only collected ornamentals, was sent to the upper Yangtze River region. And this was supposed to be, where all the bounty was, where Myers got sent south to the mountains. And, this was, considered, desolate area. But he did collect a lot of agronomic species there, mostly high-altitude ornamentals, rhubarb, lots of other things. And also he was directed at this time to start collecting insects and their predators. He also was supposed to collect as well these timber type bamboo selections. And again, one was named for him. Finally, in 1907, he gets to go where he wants to Shandong province. And he collects a lot of Prunus Davidiana, used as rootstock, and also wild pear. He also was really impressed with the hawthorns, and he thought, that he was impressed with the size, thought that they could be shipped back to the U.S., improved through breeding. He also collected the flat jujube, plum cot, and what we know today is the Meyer lemon. Now, the other thing he found was this famous Fay peach. Now, these were just marvels. He wrote that oftentimes they weighed over a pound apiece. They were only grown for the imperial court. So, no local riffraff could get these. They were only sent there, and was able to get a few of these cuttings and send them back to the States. And I'll talk more about that in a bit. So he also collected fungi, a lot of other things along this way. And here you can see, again, about every 3 months or so he was shipping things back. But here he's ready to go back to the States, and he has this 20-ton collection all loaded up here, with loquats, lemons, quince, and so on. But as you look through this list, you see the two live monkeys. And he was not happy about these monkeys. He had to bring them up every day from below deck, chase them around, and he was a plant collector, not a monkey transporter. So he was not very happy about that. So he arrives back in the United States, and amazingly, you know, 80% of his introductions survive shipment. Only one was lost to a hurricane that occurred outside of Houston. Does that sound familiar? So on his way back to D.C., he would visit the experiment stations, and he would get this list of needs or things that he thought and recommended things that he wanted to collect already on his next trip back to Central Asia. So he makes it back, and he starts sorting all these, his photographs. I mean, he was a prolific photographer. Things below, look at that lower photo. This is a freestanding, sort of slender spindle-trained apple orchard. In the middle, those are sugar cubes, very ornate, made out of persimmons. And here you can see what he spent a lot of time with was getting the translations for Chinese plant names. He did write an article, but he was not happy in the office. He wrote he would rather chop wood 3 days than do desk work for half a day. So this guy was not a writer. So off he goes on his second expedition through Europe, and he visits his contemporaries at the botanical gardens, but he arrives in Russia. And this guy did not understand the system of bribery and graft, because he had to get these permits to carry a camera, to collect plants, to hire people, and so on and so on. And so it took him about 3 months to get this all figured out. But finally off he goes to Yalta. He collects olive and fungi galls. In Georgia, he goes and collects lots of other fruit species and this evergreen hawthorn in Armenia, 31 types of grapes. And then he starts collecting pottery and shells to send back to Smithsonian. He finally gets to go to Russian Turkestan, where he collects a lot of nuts and also this Siberian bush cherry. Now, this was not a good trip here. He has to go across this Musert glacier. Their donkey carts keep falling over in these crevices. He's got near-blind guide that he hires. They about starve on this thing. And, oh, by the way, Sargent is also ragging at him all the time because he's not sending back enough herbarium species. And he doesn't even work for the guy. But he sent them, and each night he had to carry his own firewood. And at night, after walking since 3:30 in the morning, he has to dry these plant species over these fires. So he does collect several things, but he does contract typhus malaria during this trip, but he only stayed inside a couple of days. He did write, for not wanting to write, he wrote a 38-page report in 2 days, packs his plants, and off he goes. So again, during this time, he has a horrible trip, but he's hassled by and beat up by the police for, you know, about these certain permits, and also USDA was not real forthcoming with his money, and so a lot of times he would run out of money. He had to use his personal funds, and then the USDA auditors would hassle him about overexpending a penny here or a nickel there and stuff. So one of his colleagues wrote, "Stout-hearted Meyer was insulted, assaulted, denied entrance, denied exit, arrested more times probably than any other man in the service." So he was an interesting character. So Fairchild gets word of, you know, that these are sort of dangerous conditions, and he's trying to pull Meyer back. But Meyer writes this letter to assure him, and he says, "Robbers on the road murdered some people these last two nights, but a botanical collector is generally exempted from these annoyances." And in fact, he had been beaten up just the night before. So he makes it back to the U.S. He's thrilled. He sees his Chinese plant names published. He gets his calling cards, you can see right here, that were printed up. He was delighted by that. That was pretty impressive. But he writes this bulletin, and he expresses his dismay about people are naming these plants after him, and he doesn't like this. And Burbank was one of the first ones who named this cactus, you know, maybe because he was kind of a prickly fellow, named it for Meyer. But then Meyer is also upset with an entomologist because he names this insect, which Meyer considered this insidious insect, and he named him after Meyer. So he's not real happy about that. You know, I always threatened, you know, the worst pest to name, you know, after my administrators. So, this is recorded. But anyway, he spends the summer with Fairchild, and Fairchild was really worried because he had all this wealth and knowledge, but he didn't record things except on his inventory cards, and so Fairchild was really worried that some of this knowledge would be lost. Third expedition. What does this sound like? First thing he does is he gets his luggage lost. And then during this expedition, he has two bouts of malarial fever again. And again, you know, during this period of time, you know, we've got World War I starting to occur. And also Japan is threatening to invade China. So he gets there and he receives this little tiny piece of infected bark from Fairchild. And he's with instructions that he's supposed to find the fungus, chestnut blight, that's infecting American, wiping out the Chinese chestnut trees. So it takes him a couple months. You can see him down here at the bottom in a Chinese chestnut tree. And he does see that yes, indeed, you know, there are some selections that do get the blight. But he finds some that are either resistant or nearly immune to the blight. And that's what I plant today. Some of these things are the Chinese chestnut for this very reason. So he collected a lot of tomentose, a lot of walnuts. Another thing that was interesting, he found Caria capiensis, the Chinese hickory. This is the easternmost species of hickory. Also dwarf cherry used as a rootstock and many other things. Now, next he has to encounter this gang called the White Ghost Gang, who are terrorizing the local people and also foreigners. But he persists, and he collects what he considers the best persimmons in China. He's standing next to a pistachio, a Chinese pistache. He collects a lot of jujubes during this time. You can see one he said was large as a hen's egg. Maybe an exaggeration, but and several other ones. But he wants to go back and collect this famous Fei peach. And so he only makes $50 a month. And so he can't afford to collect very many of these plants. So he cooks up this scheme. He buys a plot of land. Oh, by the way, has 8 of these trees on him. Digs them up. He was very resourceful, and off he goes. The other thing he wanted to collect was this famous Pontanini peach, and I need help from you all on this. This was considered the original peach by Pontanini in 1875. But again, they're collecting and they find this human head hanging in an apricot tree. And so this just traumatizes his work crew, and they threaten to stop. They're not going any further. They get in a scuffle. He has to appear before the magistrate. He gets himself out of this. Off they go. He collects a few more things. But on the end of this trip, then, he's stopped by soldiers who think he's smuggling opium. They ransack his stuff. They rough him up. And his assistant, Van Loo, who was a German collector, his assistant, gets a little mouthy. And all of a sudden, they're lined up against the wall at the end of a rifle. So somehow they talk their way out of this and are able to come home. So finally he gets back, and again he travels back, and he's just delighted to see all his plant material that's been propagated and disseminated as we know it today. He also writes an article for the Yearbook of Agriculture, but already he's planning his next trip back to Europe. Well, his mother passes away, and he hadn't seen his family for several years. So he goes, he's on his way back, and in Minneapolis, they have this horrible, horrible drought and high temperatures. He comes down with malarial fever. He's upset about not going back through Europe, and his colleagues write that he's suffering now from nervous prostration. That sounds awful. But anyway, off he goes. He manages to get back, and on his fourth trip, he's tasked with collecting all this pear seed because Reimer in Oregon considers them to be fire blight resistant. So again, it's sweltering conditions in Central Asia. Reimer does come over and help him collect for a bit, and he was thrilled about that. But all the seed, all this pear seed is all mixed up, and so they have to get it all cleaned and send it back. He manages that. He endures, again, some really horrible conditions. He goes to this one town to get seed, and 80% of the population is suffering from syphilis. So some pretty rough conditions. He manages to also collect a lot of lemons. He sends to Swingle, smooth kiwi, lots of other things. And he stashes his material, and he makes a fatal flaw. He wants to collect one more thing. He's kind of a Columbo, just one more thing. And but he gets trapped between the revolutionaries and a government troop, so he's forced to stay there for 5 months. And this guy is just beside himself. So finally, he can't stand it any longer. He walks 60 miles basically through this war zone and very little food. Finally manages to pick up his seeds, and on the night that he's able to board the riverboat, he's got some digestive problems, also has a fever. He's sick, but he gets on board, and at 11:20, he's seen that night leaving his cabin, probably to go to the water closet, but by midnight, his cabin boy can't find him. He's reported missing, and so 5 days later, they find his body. A fisherman finds him in the river. He's buried in Shanghai. So most of his colleagues were devastated by the loss of Meyer, except for Sargent, who wrote, well, he was finally becoming, you know, a little bit useful to us, you know. But Fairchild is devastated because they were very good friends. And especially he wrote that, you know, thousands of his plants have been propagated and spread, you know, throughout the United States. As was mentioned before, USDA votes to award this medal today. It used to be awarded by the Genetics Society. Today it's by Crop Science Society of America. It shows on one side the jujube and the other side his favorite white bark pine. But I love this. Inscribed on it, in the glorious luxuriance of 1,000 plants, he takes delight. I think that's marvelous. So again, he collected all these plants over these four expeditions. I'm still working through all this. As far as I can tell, he's got 82 different species of fruits and nuts that he collected, lots of herbarium species, 2,500 letters he wrote. I mean, he would often get to some place and he'd have 200 letters waiting for him to read and to go through. All these photographs that document many of the cultural practices and these value-added products that were previously unknown to the U.S. But I think significantly he also found blight resistance. Now the last thing that I think has really gone unnoted or not highlighted as much is the contributions he's made to rootstocks. Many of the things that we use today have been developed from this material due to their stress resistance, their drought resistance, or disease resistance. Examples, diosporous lotus for persimmon, pears, used in areas for pear decline, Malus baqueta, roots, apple rootstock in Alaska and used for some of the modern rootstocks we use today. Lots of prunus species used for stone fruit. This beautiful flowering plum, it's an ornamental, but it's also used as an inner stem for European plum. And then finally, pseudocerasus that he collected is also used, crossed with avium, for cherry rootstock. So in conclusion, I mean, we really owe much to these wonderful plant collectors And this man certainly gave his life to the plants that we all know and use today. Okay? Thank you.